Black Magic Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of the land we have recorded this episode on. We also acknowledge traditional owners of the land where you, the listener or viewer, are tuning in from. We would like to pay our respects to our elders past and present and acknowledge that this always was Aboriginal land and always will be Aboriginal land.
Welcome to the Black Magic Woman podcast with Mundanara Bales.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Black Magic Woman podcast. I've been enjoying a few days here on beautiful Whadjuk Noongar country. For people that don't know Whadjuk country, I'm in Perth, Western Australia. I would say probably further from places like Fiji and Aotearoa, also known as New Zealand. So I'm a long way from home. A big shout out to my beautiful family. I know they're missing me, my little fellas, Jida and Tiger Lily and Lameki, always saying that mum doesn't give them a shout out. So I'm sitting here on the couch yarning with a beautiful sister, Nyoka Morgan, who's going to introduce herself. So sis, thank you very much for jumping on the podcast. I always ask people in their own words, and it's easy just to say, tell us, you know, who your mob is and a little bit about where you grew up.
Yeah. So I come from Shepparton originally, Yorta Yorta people. I'm the eldest of nine children from my mum. I grew up in between Shepparton and Rockhampton in Queensland, Joscaly. My dad was a South Sea Islander. My father was Italian. So we spent a lot of time going up and down the Newell Highway as children. And then we went to, we lived in Brisbane for a little while, as an early teenager, and then moved back to Shepparton. My high schooling was in between Melbourne and on the Sunshine Coast. And then when I was, 15, I was only young, I fell pregnant with my first baby, had him at 16. One of the things that, always stuck in my head as a child and seeing a lot of things that children shouldn't see and being exposed to a lot of things and growing up before your time, because mum and dad separated when I was seven, was that my children were never, ever going to live my life. Mm. And they was never going to be exposed to police raids, police brutality, because we've seen all this as children in the 80s and 90s. And so I was really hard on myself as a young parent and still am, I suppose, and had a high standard. Because I didn't want my children to go down that path.
Can I stop you for 1 minute? When you said high standard, I talk about black fellas.
Yeah.
We have high standards.
Yeah.
For ourselves, for our community, for our families. And it's interesting in a non, you know, Aboriginal, you know, society or the white fella world, that people don't think we have high standards for ourselves.
And there's two sides of that high standard. One is because we are a proud culture, and we have a lot of those qualities of family, a lot of the values. The other side of that is colonisation and the legacy of genocide, where we, as mothers, can't let our guard down. We parent on eggshells. We parent on eggshells because of the fear of welfare and the fear of losing our children.
The fact that we're under constant surveillance.
Yes.
By government authorities.
Yes.
By those organisations that work or are contracted by departments of children's services, or child protection. Mm-hmm. And being under constant surveillance, like you said, we walk on eggshells.
Yeah.
My mum didn't register any of her babies. My birth certificate was, my birth was registered in 1996. Mm. That's the fear.
Yeah.
And we're talking about within people's living memory and recent history, not over seven generations. And that there's also the intergenerational stuff.
Yeah.
But that's real. That's today. That's us.
That's right. That is us.
As black mothers.
Yeah. And we, you know, we, so I spent a lot of time supporting young people. My, you know, my professional career was in, you know, children and family services across the board. Working in different agencies from, you know, hospitals, child protection, prisons, you know, doing men's behaviour change programs. working in the Aboriginal College in Hillsville, Warrawa, supporting our people, empowering our people, and, you know, through my own personal experiences as well, that's Nayani was born, because there was no voice for the voiceless. There was, you know, we needed to, I'd spent many years, you know, in child protection, and a lot of my time in that sector was spent ensuring that my colleagues were culturally aware, ensuring that they could go and do a culturally safe assessment on Aboriginal families, because engagement is, you know, was necessary. We have a lot of our children falling through the cracks in different areas, you know, health, education, to name only two of those. There's, and...
I was going to say, those assessments...
Yes.
As soon as you said culturally safe assessments, those assessments already discriminate against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And right now in Queensland, I just saw Josh Creamer on LinkedIn, Deadliest Brother. If you haven't heard the episode with Josh Creamer, jump on and have a listen. The class action. They're calling for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families to come forward with submissions.
Yes.
Because of, you know, like you said, culturally safe assessments, culturally safe practice.
Yeah. And when we look at the legacy of colonisation, and we look at the Protection Acts and where child protection in this country came from, and when we look at it, child protection was an act of genocide. At the end of the day, that's what it was. And unfortunately, that's still going on. You know, those practices, those culturally unsafe practices are still continuing in this country, and that's why we have the high level of removal of Aboriginal children from their families.
What are we talking about in terms of data or statistics? Just to give of our listeners and viewers an insight into not what just we know as part of our lived experience as Aboriginal women that hold families together, but all the data, you would know some of the data.
So when we talk about child protection in Western Australia, we have over 5,000 children in care total, 3,600 plus of those Aboriginal children in care. So that's more than 50%. That's a lot of children in care.
In New South Wales, if those kids are in care for 2 years, the guardian or the foster carer can go for guardianship till they're 18.
Yes.
After 2 years.
Yes.
Our mothers, our women, have no chance of getting their kids back if they can't meet, you know, the standards, the expectations.
Yes. And when we talk to, you know, I'm talking to mothers, they don't know what their rights are. They don't know what to do once their children are removed. They don't know. They're being left out in the cold. You know, they have a child removed, they lose their income, which is generally Centrelink, they lose their housing, they become homeless, you know, it's...
And that leads to mental health.
Yes.
If the mental health wasn't already there at the start.
Yes.
It leads to then people in terms of, you know, depression, anxiety, opportunities to, you know, get a job or go and do further studies. Mm-hmm. That all impacts.
Yeah, it impacts. So we come in and, you know, we're talking, you know, we empower them. We give them the knowledge that they required. We will, you know, walk the journey with them to have their children, you know, come back to them. And, you know,
reuniting families.
Yes, reuniting families. And if they can't, you know, if they don't have the capacity to parent their child, then we look at who's a safe person or who's a person in your family that has the capacity to raise your children. Mm. Because we want our children back in our families.
Yeah.
We want our children in their community. Because we know that they thrive when they are with their mob.
Yeah. And there's nothing like being with your own mob.
No.
As a black fella.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, like I grew up in a household, and I always say this, is that I had the privilege to grow up with my Aboriginal mother and father.
Yeah.
My mum was removed. She was a ward of the state. She was institutionalised. Her mother was a ward of the state.
Mm.
She was removed. I've got five generations on my mother's side that were stolen children.
Yeah,
That's five generations of trauma that my mother unknowingly passed on to her eight babies.
Yeah.
One of my four of my sisters have been in and out of prison. Two of my sisters have had their children removed.
Mm.
Now my nieces, my sister's children, they've got their children removed.
Yeah.
So there's obviously, you know, the system isn't working, and we know that the system, you know, has done nothing really to support Aboriginal women in particular to build capacity or capability and, you know, in terms of preventative stuff. How are we working with families when we identify before the children are being taken or before the children are at risk, you know?
So there's not – so a lot of the – a majority of the funding when it comes to these issues goes to out-of-home care. There's no funding – there's
so out-of-home
minimal
care,
funding. There's minimal funding for prevention.
Okay. Out-of-home care, some of those providers are non-government organisations, NGOs.
Yes.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't realise you've got the government. The government have the funding.
That's right.
And the funding then usually gets obviously dispersed to service providers on the ground.
Yes.
So whether it's a Mission Australia, Anglicare, Uniting Care, some of these are faith-based organisations that were also removing our kids. Like I can't literally, sis, when I looked into this, I was delivering cultural capability training for one of these faith-based organisations, and my elders, two of them, Auntie Mary and Auntie Lilla, they actually wrote the kinship principles in Queensland. They got that legislation over the line that these are the steps that you need to take before you remove a kid and put them into a non-Aboriginal home. Those principles have never been not just enforced but enacted, and there's no accountability.
Yeah.
And this is back in the 1970s when Annie Lilla, my business partner at Black Card, she was the chairperson of Aboriginal childcare.
Yeah.
Annie Mary Graham was the manager. These two old girls are both professors at the University of Queensland, working, you know, founded Black Card with me. The only workshop in 10 years that they wanted to walk out on was with one of these organisations. The level of disrespect amongst this group, majority under the age of 30, majority fresh out of university, and they did not have children.
That's
and
right.
they are in, they're in.
And when you look at, when I came to work in Child Protection in Western Australia, all the care teams, which is the teams that look after the out-of-home care, the children that have been removed from their families and put into care, majority of those staff, the case managers, were fresh out of university, didn't have life experiences.
I saw it, sis.
Yeah, and don't have children of their own.
No, and they are making these decisions that impact on our lives.
Yes.
The individual, the child, the siblings, the family, the mother, the community, the grandmothers, the aunties, the uncles, the whole community suffer.
Yeah.
The whole community grieve when our children are taken
from,
you know, this little tight unit.
And the family.
So what do you think needs to be done? Obviously, there's a class action happening in Queensland. What do you think as an Aboriginal woman that's, you know, dedicated most of your career to working in these spaces, what needs to happen?
Our families need to stick together. Our families need to come back together. Our communities need to stick together. We need to stop relying on the government to improve our lives because it's not going to happen.
No.
It's not going to happen at all. We need money in prevention. That's where the funding needs to start going, into prevention. We need to work together and to come together to bring our kids home.
Mm-hmm.
Our children belong with family.
And on your T-shirt, sis, that's exactly your, our kids belong with family. How do we get, though, government are in control, right? If people don't understand that Aboriginal people, you know, constantly fighting for, you know, self-determination and autonomy, we're not in control of our own affairs. As black fellas living in this country now known as Australia, we have no control. We don't have a say when it comes to policies that impact on our lives. And this is one example. One example, but this is crucial. If a child is not raised in their Aboriginal family and connected to their Aboriginal culture and identity, you wonder why we have the highest rate of youth suicide than anywhere else in the world. Closing the gap, if you look at the last report, and you can go onto the Productivity Commission's website, have a look on the dashboard in real time. The gap isn't closing. The last report, it said that in the last 12 months, closing the gap was failing.
Yes.
So what are our alternatives in terms of now thinking about black fellas that are running their own show? We're doing our own thing. We're in business. We're doing the best that we can to be able to provide these essential services to family and community. What can we do as black fellas in business?
I think that we are doing it already.
Yeah.
We talk about self-determination, going into business is self-determination.
Yeah.
It's becoming independent.
Yeah.
I've employed myself. I've given myself a job, And, Nayani is not going to be a one-man show for a long time. I'm already strategizing how we scale up, how we get family coaches in every capital city in Australia, and then we start on the regions.
Mm-hmm. So that's what's missing coaching.
We build the economics in community.
Yeah.
We give each other positions. It doesn't matter if I'm a Koori working on Noongar country, I'm a black woman. With lived experience.
Right, you didn't just tick the box yesterday.
I didn't.
And that's the difference too.
And it's,
our communities need to support us.
That's right.
I live on the Sunshine Coast. I'm not a cubby cubby woman. Yeah. I live in Brisbane as well and go between the two. I'm not a Yuggera or Turrbal woman.
Yeah.
But I know that the work that I'm doing in this space, not just with podcasting, but with upskilling mostly non-Aboriginal people with cultural capability, cultural competence, and getting them to understand Aboriginal culture and history. Mm. I'm doing the work with my elders right across this country, and that's what brought me here to Whadjuk Noongar country, is to give Australians an understanding of our shared history. Yeah. It starts with truth-telling.
Yep.
Because if you don't understand the position that we're in 2024 now, if you don't understand the position, if you don't understand why your organisation's got a reconciliation action plan, if you don't understand why closing the gap was born, then we're going backwards.
Yes.
So we need to understand the past to make sense of the present
to
then figure out a way forward.
Yeah.
And this is, with us as black fellas, understanding our own trauma.
That's right.
Our own family history. Yeah. For me to understand, my mum was removed and my nan, I didn't know all of this growing up because I never spoke about it.
Yeah.
So now for me, being in business, trying to develop training and training packages, I never get a call from any child protection agencies.
Mm.
I never get a call from any of those providers that have those contracts. And they're the ones that are removing children, making those decisions, or they're the ones that are, going and checking on them. But they don't have any, foundational knowledge for them to make better decisions to keep our families together. So it's like they're coming in with a mindset already. They've already made up their mind that they're going to take children.
Yeah.
So before that even happens, there are key Aboriginal organisations all around the country that should be doing the prevention work and should be doing or should be funded to do so.
And the issue is that when you're struggling as a parent, as a mum or a dad, where do you get the help from?
Mm.
Where do you go for support? Because you ring up the agencies, whether, they're a non-government agency or an ACCO.
Now you're flagging yourself. Yeah, if you ring up and ask for support.
Because they don't help. That you've got to be under child protection to get the support.
That's where the funding is,
and that's where all the funding is.
Once you say
I'm at rock bottom. Yeah, yeah.
I'm at rock bottom. Next minute, children taken because you've asked for help. I've heard this, sis, that a lot of people are the ones that have put their hand up.
Yeah,
they didn't get the knock on the door. They put their hand up. and then found themselves in a position that their children were taken.
Yeah.
And then it's an uphill battle to get your children back.
Yeah.
So do you work with families? You do a lot of the family, the prevention. You're trying to work prevention. With families.
So we do.
To focus on keeping.
Keeping kids at home.
Keep the kids at home, yeah.
Yeah, keeping the kids at home or in the family.
Yeah.
You know, because
extended family, grandmothers, aunties, uncles.
Yes, cousins. We always forget about the cousins too, you know. So, you know, it's about supporting parents to look after themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody needs a break. There's a time when people need a break. You know, things happen in our community. You know, we have a lot of deaths in our community. We're interconnected. We're so, you know, we're very connected. So when people talk about people, oh, she went to a funeral last week and she's going to another one this week. Well, yeah, that does happen. That's our reality. That's our reality. Some days there's more than one funeral and you've got to make a decision what to go to funerals. You know? So there's a lot of grief.
Yeah.
And there's intergenerational trauma. There's a lot of traumas. Poverty? What about the poverty in our communities? And we talk about living, living expenses raising in the last year since
mm-hmm.
COVID.
Mm-hmm.
How are our people making ends meet?
Yeah.
I don't understand it. I go to the supermarket and I get a basket of stuff for dinner. And there's $140.
Easy.
For three people.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of Aboriginal people are living below the poverty line, and the data is there. You don't have to go too far on Google to find what we're talking about. Everything is there to back up what we're talking about. But the fact that only 1 in 10 Indigenous people are financially secure, 1 in 10.
Yes.
In my family, I feel that I'm the 1 in 100.
Mm.
I feel that there's a lot of people in my family and community that unfortunately will never be in a position to buy a home.
No.
Home ownership in this country. Like for white fellas, and let's just be real here, there's a lot of intergenerational wealth passed down.
That's right, yes.
Right? Whereas in for us, that wealth wasn't passed down. We helped create it, but it was then dispersed to the owners of the properties and then back to government. So here we are in 2024, and still have some of the worst living conditions in the world. And we're talking about third world countries. Mm-hmm. We're comparing our mob in this country, a developed country, and probably the richest country in the world when you think about mining and resources, one of the wealthiest countries in the world.
Mm.
And yet we still got black fellas, you know, living in third world conditions.
That's right.
So poverty plays a big part.
Yeah.
You know, and education, you know, our people were denied an education. Mm. Our people have been locked out of the economy to participate in business or to start their own businesses. So for any of our mob in particular that are listening or watching on YouTube that might be struggling and they haven't asked for support.
Well, they don't know where to go for support.
They don't know where to go.
They don't know what their rights are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we will support, you know, jump on our website, book in a discovery call, and we can have a chat. We'll have a yarn. It's a yarn.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's all it is. Sometimes it's that one 30-minute discovery call where it can empower my clients to get on with it, you know, to achieve what they thought was unachievable.
Of course.
To give them, you know, the sense of hope back and to hold on to faith. Because, yeah, the system is not built for our people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we look at the state of Western Australia, they only had one Aboriginal out-of-home care service until late last year when there was some contracts given to other Aboriginal providers. One out-of-home care service provider out of, I think it was about 127.
And more than 50% of the children.
Yes.
More than 50% of the children living in out-of-home care in Western Australia are Aboriginal kids.
Yes.
And yet only last year a few service providers got
Until,
the funding
as
black organisations.
As Aboriginal organisations.
That's absolutely disgusting.
It is disgusting.
But it's not surprising, is it?
No, it's not surprising. It's not surprising. And when we talk about, and when we talk about funding and money, we talk about if it costs $100,000 as a base for one child in out-of-home care, times that by 3,200.
It doesn't make sense.
That's a lot of money.
Yes.
It's a lot of money.
It's a business. It's an industry.
It is. It's become an industry. Our children have become an industry. Our families have become an industry.
And all I could think about, you know, with our children needing family, needing community, needing culture, needing a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
You know, that's what sets people up.
That's right.
For not success, it sets us up to live a full life.
Yes.
You know, to be able to reach our full potential as black fellas in this country,
yeah,
it needs to start with our children.
It does.
Having access to their community, having access to culture, having access to their families.
Yeah.
What about our women in prison?
You know,
because WA's got the worst statistics in the country with women in prison.
Yeah.
In fact, Aboriginal women are the fastest growing prison demographic in the country, if not in the world.
Yes.
That's how bad it is.
Yeah. There's, for some reason, I'm not too sure why or what happened, in 2015-16, our incarceration rate of Aboriginal women just increased dramatically. Now there's, and majority of those women that are incarcerated, that are in prison, are mothers.
80%, the data says.
Yeah. So where are the children? We do have some facilities where children, mums can have their babies, you know, mums are given birth whilst they're incarcerated, so they can have their babies until they're 12 months old. Some mothers can have their children until they're about 4 years of age in some minimum security prisons. The uptake of those programs are higher for Aboriginal people than non-Aboriginal people. But the work that we're going to be doing in the prisons is around connection to children whilst in prison and reconnecting after prison, but also our cultural authority as mothers as well and how we keep that. Because regardless if we're in prison or not, we're still mothers and we still have that role. And it's very important. The system has us thinking that we're not good enough.
That we've failed.
That we've failed. We've failed as mothers. We've failed our children. We haven't failed our children.
The system has failed us.
The system has failed us.
Yeah.
They have failed us.
And our children are the ones that are punished in the end.
Yes. So it's so we're doing some work there. That's I'm excited about that, to be doing that.
Because it's hard to sometimes keep hope and to be optimistic. So when you said I'm excited about that, I wanted to say to you, what are you looking forward to for 2024? What's on the radar? What's on the horizon? The prison work, working
the prison
with women,
work,
which is so important.
Yes. I've also started some preliminary conversations with the Perrin Institute. So the Perrin Institute is does work on the brain. So one of the programs that I'm very interested in is around using the DNA to get to look at mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that our mental health is an issue.
Yeah.
And because, you know, and that's also to prevent suicides, but also our people are put on a lot of prescription drugs for their mental health.
Of course.
And, you know, they don't all work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they mightn't be on the right.
What if they can't afford, what if they cannot afford their prescriptions? That's another issue.
That's another issue. Look, a lot of people don't see a counsellor or a psychologist because they can't afford to pay for one.
Yeah.
The waiting list is too long.
Yeah. Culturally so unsafe.
Culturally unsafe.
There's not enough psychologists that are black fellas that actually understand the experience that we have, which is unique, unfortunately, to black fellas.
That's right. Yeah. So, and, you know, again, we talk about assessment tools, and assessment tools aren't culturally appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
They don't consider our cultural needs. So it's, you know, and these are the things that we want to change. We want to improve people's well-being all over, you know, their spiritual well-being, their emotional, you know, their mental health.
Mm-hmm.
and that's I'm excited for that. And also hoping that we can do some work with in the juvenile justice area.
Yeah.
Hoping to do that. And I say I'm excited about this, and, you know, people say, oh, why are you excited for that, you know, because it's about breaking the curses.
That's been around for how many generations?
Breaking the curses of genocide, getting our families back together, empowering our young children. You know, in the state of Western Australia, we have one youth detention centre, and that's in Perth.
Long way from home for
a lot
of them.
It's a long way from home for a lot of them. So what it does is it disconnects children, because they are children, from their family, from their community, from their cultural practices. Families can't visit. It's a long way. They don't have the funds. They don't have the accommodation.
Just let people know that's Banksia.
That's
Youth
Banksia.
Detention Centre. Yeah. And there is a lot of international pressure on Banksia at the moment. Right, in terms of breaches of human rights.
Yes.
That detention centre, most people, I actually educate people about Dondale and Banksia to let people know that some of our children in these detention centres, especially in Dondale, there was a documentary called, and you can have a look at it, it's Australia's Shame, and it highlights the treatment of Aboriginal children in Dondale Youth Detention Centre. And the expert on camera, I will never forget these words. It haunts me some days. He said that the treatment of Aboriginal children in Dondale Youth Detention Centre was up there with the treatment of detainees in Guantanamo Bay.
Yes.
Our children are not rehabilitating in these centres. They're coming out traumatised.
Yes.
The data's there. The evidence is there. There was an inquiry into Dondale. Go and read the report.
Yeah.
So in terms of Banksia, when you said there's one detention centre here, I had to call out and name the detention centre because a lot of people don't even know what's happening in Banksia.
No, and it's horrible what's happening there. And, you know, when we hear about the riots that happen in Banksia, what about the little 10-year-old that's in there on remand? That's been exposed to this, that's being traumatised by the riots, you know. What about the 12-year-old?
Yeah.
So it's there's a lot happening.
Yeah.
And our children shouldn't be exposed to this behaviour. So hopefully we can get in and we can start doing some work, because what we need to do is we need to reduce these incarceration rates. And it's up to us to do it.
Yeah.
Not the government.
Yeah. I don't know, but people always say, you know, if they're in there, they're meant to be there and all of this stuff. Look, let's put that aside for now.
Yeah.
Because if you don't understand our shared history in this country, then I don't think you should even have an opinion. If you don't understand systemic and institutional racism, or you have never been on the receiving end of racism and discrimination, I don't think you're informed to an opinion. So I have these arguments with people every now and again when I really feel fired up. So doing the work that you do, obviously you're doing a lot to also inspire a lot of us deadly black women.
Yeah.
To wrap up our yarn, what keeps you going? How do you look after yourself? How do you look after Nyoka?
I go shopping for shoes. No, I walk every
and that's okay.
Yeah,
that's
every day
to do that for ourselves, to treat ourselves, to pamper ourselves. Yeah.
But I walk just about every day. I do Pilates twice a week, and I eat well.
Yeah,
you know, I look after myself.
Yeah,
because if I don't look after myself, nobody else is going to do it.
Yeah,
and that's it.
And I think that's the most important thing that people realize that. You know, we're in business, we're mums, we're aunties, we're sisters, we're granddaughters. Yeah. We're doing a lot.
That's right.
In our community as mothers, because culturally that's what we've always done.
That's right. Yeah.
That's all we know.
Yeah.
So I just want to say I have literally waited for a long time to finally have this yarn. I didn't think Zoom was the right way to do the yarn, to just sit and have a yarn and kind of catch up at the same time.
Yeah.
You know what? I saw Louis Vuitton downstairs. I was walking to the workshop yesterday and I stopped at the doorway and all I heard was my husband saying, keep walking. So I just want to say I absolutely love everything you do, the fashion, the dresses, every time I see you at different events and online, and the beautiful posts that you put. Yeah. You remind me to love myself.
You have to.
Yeah, you remind me to look after myself. Good. When I see your post, you know, sometimes I feel like, oh, I couldn't do that. I couldn't post that. And I'm like, no. Why can't I feel, you know, comfortable in showing people that I look after myself, that I treat myself? Yeah. Why, you know, and that's something that I always struggle with.
Yeah, no, we shouldn't have to struggle with that. And, you know, we are allowed to, we're allowed to be flash.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with us being flash.
No.
And, you know, Louis Vuitton, I walk up, I have a personal shopper in Louis Vuitton now, you know, and it's, why can't I have that?
Yeah.
As afforded to the rest of the community.
Yes.
You know, so, yeah.
Isn't that interesting, hey, just as black women.
Yeah.
That make our own money, I'm not government funded. You're not government funded. You might get some government funding, but our core business relies on us bringing in that money.
Yeah.
And employing other people.
That's right.
You know, and paying our own bills and paying our mortgages. Yeah. People think that successful Aboriginal people in business must be government funded. How could you potentially be successful without the government support? Well, let me tell you now, I know a lot of black fellas that are successful and that have made it. And that are also, you know, getting to that point where they realise their own success.
Yeah.
And that should be celebrated.
That's right.
I can't wait for us to catch up again.
Yes.
And, you know, find opportunities and make the time for each other to catch up and just have a yarn.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for making time for me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
I can't wait to go shopping with you. I'll see you at Louis Vuitton. That's our next date. On that note, I just want to say thank you very much for tuning in, listening and watching now on YouTube. I hope you've enjoyed this yarn. Until next time, bye for now. If you'd like any more info on today's guest, please visit our show notes in the episode description. A big shout out to all you Deadly Mob and allies who continue to listen, watch and support our podcast. Your feedback means the world. You can rate and review the podcast on Apple and Spotify or even head to our socials and YouTube channel and drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. The Black Magic Woman podcast is produced by Clint Curtis.